Hello and welcome to another Idealized Science Institute science education podcast. I'm here as always with Dr. Brian Wargo. How's it going?
Hello, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Wargo. Today we're talking about peer instruction, which is something that I asked Wargo to discuss today because it was one of the topics in my physics education research class that I was very interested in. That we didn't dive into as much detail there as I would have liked. And, you know, I think it's, as we're going to talk about, you know, sort of two important papers in this area, we'll see that it's a pretty interesting paradigm in science education that, at least at the college level, is still pretty uncommon, I'd say. So, you know, maybe without further ado, we can jump in and give a summary. Wargo, if you'd want to do that, just, you know, of the two papers that I sent you, or maybe I guess I sent you three, we'll probably focus on the first two. And if you just want to give a little summary, and then we can jump in.
I'll give you a little history also, but the paper is titled Peer Instruction, 10 Years of Experience and Results, and it's by Catherine H. Crouch and Eric Mazur. And I remember this era. This is 2001. And I remember being at the university, and I was in physics, and it was like a real, like you said, a paradigm shift. And the culture was changing also. And this PI is what they call it, peer instruction. It was all the rave. I mean, we would have seminars and discussions around campus talking about this new way of engaging students. And I remember there was just this tension there because you had the traditionalists and you had some newer educators that were thinking, no, we're ripe for a change. And essentially what peer instruction is about is becoming student-centered. I mean, that's really what this is about. And it's going to bring in a new wave of thinking about how we interact with students. And in this particular case, it was around physics teaching. And so I just want to give props to the physics departments because they were by far ahead of the curve compared to the other disciplines in STEM.
Absolutely. So we're going to discuss one of the sort of earlier papers, it started, as they say, in the one you just introduced, about 10 years prior to when they're writing this article. But we're sort of going to talk about what the findings were 10 years in. And so that's peer instruction, 10 years of experience and results. And we'll link these in the show notes. And then the other one that caught my eye when I was, this was not one that was covered in my class, but I thought was at least a provocative title, which is Why Peer Discussion Improves Student Performance on In-Class Concept Questions. So the promise of that title, at least, is that they're going to give an actual explanation for why what is observed when peer instruction is used. And so maybe just let's define peer instruction now before talking a bunch about it. What it is you have a in-class concept question, clicker question, you call them, you know, we call them quick quizzes, whatever it might be. Something that's meant to foster dialogue and also just have the students actively engage with the material. You have students answer after being asked the question the first time, and then you have them discuss in small groups. And after a discussion for a few minutes, you have them vote again and answer again. And the observed, the data show that typically students answer more correctly after their engagement with their peers. This is sort of the main takeaway of peer instruction. And the data over a number of departments and a number of different levels and a number of different institutions. So Eric Mazur and Catherine Crouch are at Harvard, but that, you know, they specify and show in this sort of review that these findings were replicated in many other institutions, not just one that, you know, would be considered elite. So that's sort of the setting that we're going to be talking about. And then this article that says, you know, why peer discussion improves student performance. This was published in Science in 2009 from Michelle K. Smith at University of Colorado and a several other authors. And so I was intrigued by that title because I think it's always a bold claim when you say you're going to actually explain why some teaching method works, right? So I guess before we move into the review article, you know, you want to just give your thoughts on this explanatory article and you know, if you think they actually achieve their goal of explaining why, and then we can jump into the data.
So we got to go back a couple decades. The departments didn't talk very much. I mean, if you had the physics department, there's no way they had interaction with educational researchers. They were just, they were distinct. They were probably different places on campus. So while this was remarkable in the physics department, I think the educational researchers would have been saying, you're just getting around to this now, right? Mm. But I mean, it was palpable at the time where you had, and I have to say, Eric Mazur, being from Harvard, really led a lot of weight to this type of research. Harvard was one of the few educational research powerhouses at the time. And so most people thought, well, if Harvard's doing it with their education, there's something to this. And of course there is. So the peer instruction is essentially saying physics professors, physics teachers for generations have been saying, why are our students not learning what I'm telling them? I'm up at the board and I'm delivering these wonderful lectures and it's almost like they're not getting it. And the research clearly shows they're not getting it. And so, we have to also remember that physics is considered a hardcore science. And what makes it hardcore is that quantitativeness of it, you know, like doing the equations and bringing the math in. So while the students seem to be doing abysmal job at the quantitative stuff, it didn't matter because all the tests were really about using the numbers. Can you do the math? But when they really started looking at how badly, you know, I mean, this is going to lead into misconception research and so on. Our students were really faking their way through. And it was like, wait, what the professors have been saying for all this time is, I don't think they're getting it. I don't think they're getting it. What's wrong? And part of what was wrong is, well, we weren't really engaging with the students in an appropriate manner. And the way that we learn is through dialogue. And so that was like an opening. But we have to keep in mind that, you know, even when I was going through university, some of the professors would literally want to just go through the book. They would say, "Oh, open up to page 35," and if you went back a generation before me, they would read the book to the right. students. You know, like right. I have to be there in order for you to understand this. Now it's this idea, and there's several ideas packed into this article, and that's why they say 10 years of experiments. You know that. No, students, you should be reading this on your own before you come to class. We'll then highlight some of the aspects that we might think that you have difficulty with.
Right.
So this seems so rudimentary when we look at, oh, maybe we should think about how the students are interacting with the material. But this was, you know, there's a culture that is going to have a lot of inertia. And so, again, this was a very big change. And I remember going to... I was in Indiana University at Pennsylvania, but I remember going down to Pitt for seminars and discussions. I was also at the time the vice president of this Physics Teachers Association here in Pittsburgh. And I remember we'd get together and we'd talk about some of these new things. And I mean, it really was, and I'll use the word revolutionary, about thinking on how students are, you know, interacting in our class with the material, the professor, and then most of all with each other. That was a big one. And that's what this peer instruction is about. Now you're going to end up talking to the person next to you. Now think of your professor. You're thinking, why in the world would I ever have students talk to someone? They don't know the answers to these.
Yep,
they're just going to confuse them more. But when they collected data on this, it turns out, no, everyone was gaining. Everyone was gaining, even if you were paired with someone else who didn't already know an answer to some right. stimulating question. It was the act of dialogue. And I'll say it again. I'm sure the cognitive psychologists are sitting back because they had their revolution much earlier. And they're saying, you know, we found this out a while ago. But again, it might not have been taken seriously or been taken as something that the hard sciences wanted to be involved with, you know? So it's an interesting dynamic.
It is an interesting dynamic. The history and the context you're providing is super useful. I am certainly not nearly as familiar with the sort of tangential research that would be in these in psychology, cognitive science, these sorts of fields. Mm-hmm. But I do know that the history of, discipline-based education research, certainly a lot of these things, even if they weren't given this name, a lot of the ideas that are used today have been around for a long time, but peer instruction, at least reading about it, really formalized this sort of protocol to implement in the class. And maybe a couple things you said, as always, as you're saying these things, I have several ideas pop into my head that would be great to talk about. But one that, I actually annotated when I was reading through this, and you just touched on, is they ask the students to read before they come to class. Okay, so this the thing that I wondered here, and maybe you can shed some light on it, is I don't know how they control for the time that the students put in before class, because I don't see it as a fair comparison if you say, okay, let's compare traditional instruction, where it's going to be, let's say, 50 minutes, mm-hmm. in of class time, and now we're going to compare that to 50 minutes of class time plus, who knows, if someone reads, takes it very seriously and reads a chapter or something in depth, it could be, it could be 2-3 additional hours. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how in science education research you would take this into account. And specifically, then with relationship to peer instruction, that's sort of the protocol, is let's have them read the key things ahead of time, maybe even do an exam before they come, just a few questions, open-ended, that test understanding. And then you actually do the peer instruction once you're in class. So I don't know if you can talk a little bit about that. That's something that was not clear to me from reading these.
Well, you just touched upon all the flaws with educational research, right? A lot of it was self-reporting. So students would end up self-reporting how much they read. And we know that that's always going to be skewed and inaccurate. So,
which way do you think it would be skewed? Which way do you think it would be
Both
more
ways.
Likely to be skewed?
But by and large, if you were to ask professors and say, are your students really reading this? And if they're reading it, are they reading it for understanding? And the answer is no. A, they're not reading it. And second of all, even if they are, they're going across the words. They're not really engaging with it. So there were these complaints all the way back then. But in this paper, it does talk about, look, we're going to have formal recitations. We're going to end up having other times where you're working with a teacher, a teaching assistant. And so they were able to formalize that a little bit better so that their results did not have quite as much uncertainty in it. There's several pieces in here that we need to talk about. First of all, how are they measuring the gains? The methodology
can we take one sec before getting into that just to try and answer the time question? Maybe I missed it, but is there a clear answer to, because it really does feel, okay, let's say the traditional lecture is considered lecture and recitation. Mm-hmm. If that's, I don't know, what would it maybe be, 4 hours a week or something? It feels like the peer instruction, the added reading and the added pre-quiz would add some significant time. And you're saying they self-report, so then they just try to normalize based on what people reported they worked on, and then normalize to the total amount of time? Or how's that taken into account?
Now, this is, I'm speaking generally here. So what the paper actually says is, look, they came to a condition where they were like, we can't cover all of this anymore. So they said, we're going to have to just either A, put it on the students and have them doing it on their own, or they said, and this was the big one, I don't think it had ever been said before, maybe we need to cut down on so much
cover less content.
cover less. And so that is what they're essentially saying, consider teaching. And I think they put 15% less of the curriculum,
right.
Maybe take out some of the smaller ideas. Or if you're going to take those out, you put them directly on the students. There's nothing difficult about this. Read this. You're still going to get test questions
right.
on it. And so
right.
on. So that's how they handled it. But
right.
that led to today, where we now realize that you just can't cover everything. You just can't. And so I think it was one of the first times that a lot of professors had to take this seriously. Are we going to cut some of this material out? And they did.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. So I guess the reason, do you see why that bothered me though? Is because if you're just saying, look, if students do more work, like if you're just demanding, or on average, they put in more time, then you could explain away the learning gains by just saying you did double the time in preparation. So you have double the learning gain, right?
But you remember, how are they looking at the gains? They are looking now at qualitative, and they're using this new test that came out, you know, the previous decade, called the FCI, the Force Concept Inventory Test. And that had already been validated that it doesn't matter how much you study, you still can have a whole load of misconceptions in there. And so what they were testing is, how are you able to handle the problems that have known misconceptions in them? And
right.
So I think that was a really awesome way that they were to say, look, we already understand how students are, you know, missing some of the qualitative stuff, but now they have a validated test that can show this. And so,
right.
Yeah.
So I think
because
that
more time did not necessarily equate to better scores on the FCI.
So that I definitely agree with. Okay, so maybe that's my misunderstanding, and let me run it back to you to see if it's correct. But what I'm basically saying is, suppose you have 1 hour of peer instruction and interaction, you know, the what maybe is called like a hybrid sort of lecture setting, where there are some lectures in the sense that there is someone with more expertise at the front of the room presenting something, and then you have these concept test questions. What I'm saying, if you had an hour of that versus an hour of whatever is defined as traditional lecturing, so someone up at the board just in transmission style reciting things, I'm trying to say, if you know, are they being careful to compare 1 hour to 1 hour? And you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, that isn't as relevant as I think it is, because on these force concept inventories and the mechanics baseline test, these sort of validated concept inventories, it doesn't really matter how much time you put in. It really targets understanding, not just the time spent cramming for it. Is that correct, or am I missing something?
But no. What you're saying is correct, but the paper also indicates that instructors had some leeway here. Some of them might only give one of these questions that might take 10 minutes during a lecture, and several might do a few of those integrated in between. So there was an awful lot of, you know, personalization between instructors. But the important thing on the second paper is, and the first paper, is it said, no. It turns out that we see the gains despite the peculiarities of the instructors. And so that was what was really remarkable, is that it doesn't matter who's doing this. If any teacher starts to attempt these, even for a little bit, the gains are there. And they were remarkable gains on the FCI. But then you have to think about, okay, are they still giving the same style of test that used to just be quantitative? And they're basically saying, yeah. Because, and this makes sense, a lot of the tests used to be, can you manipulate symbols? Can you do the algebra, and can you do the math?
Right.
Well, if you had that, you didn't really need to understand that much physics. You have to understand what the question's asking. You say, I'm going to math my way out of this, and maybe I still have all these misconceptions. So they were trying to do this delicate balance. And, you know, while this seems such an easy thing to do, right, it turns out, to validate it, it's really difficult because you have to ask all these questions. And so what did they do? They ended up increasing the N value. They did it year after year with different professors, different classes, different institutions. And by seeing this, it was without a doubt, no, we're seeing real gains. Because remember, on the FCI, and this is so depressing, the FCI, typically you would expect after you take that test on the first day and then you take it on the last day, and you see a 20% gain from an entire year of physics coursework. Right. I mean, it was abysmal. It basically made teachers want to, A, say there's something broken with our students, or to say, oh my, I'm a terrible instructor. So when you start to see these kind of gains, I mean, everyone was just rejoicing.
Right. Absolutely. And so maybe, I know we've probably talked about it before, but maybe we should just, if you could just give a little more context on the FCI, the Force Concept Inventory, just what it is, when it came out, and what it aims to do. And I really like that you emphasized how difficult it is to validate these metrics. That's something I didn't appreciate until I took this PER class with Noah Finkelstein at University of Colorado. It is actually remarkable how much time and effort goes into validating even a single new concept inventory, or even the tutorials in physics. I mean, whole PhDs were dedicated to making, you know, three or four good tutorials. It's crazy. So anyway, if you can just give a little more concept on the on the FCI, that'd be great.
So FCI was specifically targeting ideas and misconceptions that were known. You know, you might have a very simple drawing about a spacecraft moving, and if I give it an impulse, whatever they wanted to call it, what would be the shape of the arc that it would make? Would it go in a straight line? Would it go straight up? Would it curve? Things of that nature. Things that you couldn't necessarily fake through. And the FCI turns out to target many of the ideas in basic mechanics. And that's like the mainstay of physics. So probably came out I'm saying in the very early 90s. I remember getting it as an instructor myself for the first time. It was like signing my life away. They're like, look, you can't let the students have it. It was so important that teachers were trying these things, but at the same time, you cannot let this get out. And so I remember taking it, and I remember thinking, this is a great test. I cannot fake my way through this with numbers. Some of these, as a physics teacher, I was challenged by, and I was thinking, I love it. I thought this was great. I was like, I really need to think about this because I want to say it's this, but now I'm thinking a different way. So that kind of excitement generated within teachers, I thought, was just awesome. And then there was also, do you remember the name of the other test, the mechanics MTB, I think
baseline
it was?
Baseline test, the mechanics baseline test. So that was also, that was also 92, actually. So both of these are from Hestenes and Wells, and the FCI also had another author, Swackhammer, on it. And that was 1992 that those came out. And the mechanics baseline test, which I actually have not looked at. And so to your point of how secure they still are, I wanted to look at some of the questions on the MBT. And I went to find it. And again, we'll link all these in the show notes, how to find these through FizzPort and AAPT's other, offerings of these. But you have to sign up and be validated as an educator to even gain access to these. And
it
so
was like a personal email, and you would say, this is what I plan on doing. And you know, it would be a back and forth exchange. They wouldn't just send it to you at the time. So. I used to give the FCI in my class, but after year, you see the same results. You understand, where you're getting the gains. You're like, this is just taking a lot of time. I see the same thing. There's no reason to think that this group would be any different if I'm not changing anything. So, there's a quote in this paper, and I'm wearing the wrong glasses because when I read these articles, I have to wear my magnifiers. So I'm having a hard time reading my own writing here. But I love this quote here. We're talking about trying to get professors on board. You had to get students on board on this qualitative stuff too. They would give, and I quote, because I know this is what everyone felt. So when are we going to get to the real physics? I mean, they were basically saying, quit wasting my time. I'm at the university here, and you're drawing pictures for me about a ship, and you want to know the shape. Give me a differential equation or something like that.
Right.
And so it's that mentality that we have to remember. Nowadays, instructors will really bend over backwards for their students. They're judged on how their students judge them, at the end of a course and things of that nature. Back then, it just wasn't like that. So that's why this is such an important piece in the history to realize where we were and how it pulled us screaming and crying, both from instructors and students and the culture, to the gains that we see now.
Totally. Totally. One thing that is worth, I think, jumping into a little bit, and I don't think they address it in an explanatory way, but they mention it, which is that on the questions that were considered primarily quantitative on the mechanics baseline test, students, the gains were still lower, roughly at 5% lower than overall. So what that means to me is that these techniques of peer instruction are better at targeting conceptual understanding than they are quantitative understanding. I don't think that's that unbelievable,
no,
right?
No, that's remember, you're spending, you're finally spending some time with the qualitative. So, and other studies showed that in general, it did not make that much of a difference for the quantitative, right? But remember, you were asking about the time constraint. Remember, now lecture was now sometimes reduced to half of what it was before. And that lecture might have been derivations and things of that nature. So they start getting away from that. So when you think of it per time unit, the time unit that you're spending on the same quantitative scores that you're getting is very different, but you're doing it almost in a more efficient manner if you wanted to think of it that way. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah, that does make sense. That's definitely fair. If you're spending less time doing derivations, yet you're only seeing a small, like if you're seeing, you're having drastically less time spent doing derivations, yet you only see a very small decrease in the quantitative competency. That's fair. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's definitely.
And other studies showed that you didn't actually gain or didn't actually lose anything on the quantitative. So
okay, interesting.
It's a
small
or nil, you know.
Okay, all right. That's very fair. So this one, in this paper, they say the average score on those questions, on the quantitative ones, are about 5% lower. Of course, how significant 5% is depends on sort of the ranges that we're talking about with any of these. But that's, I'm sure, then if you read the later reviews and stuff, review articles and meta-analyses, then you're saying that there's either essentially no statistically significant change, or it's a very small decrease.
I actually thought in this paper that they said there were gains also. I could be wrong. I have the wrong glasses
on. On the quantitative questions.
MBT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the MBT, there absolutely were gains, but there were 9 questions in the MBT that they isolated as primarily quantitative, and the statement was just, the average score on those questions was about 5% lower than the MBT overall. That was the statement that caught my eye, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why. Your explanation's pretty, like, that is the obvious explanation.
Yeah,
I just didn't think of it. Is if you normalize for the amount of time spent doing derivations, then it's actually pretty remarkable that it's only a small decrease, or, you know. And then, of course, maybe there's more on the, you know, and they said they do this, but the logical thing to me then was, and this, I've had to do this in the few experiences that I've had teaching, is I know I'm not going to get through this derivation in class. I know that it's more important to have the discussions. And so I make a very detailed handout, you know, a page or two showing every single step with, you know, notes and stuff along the way, and then have the students just go through that on their own time. And for a lot of people, that's probably more valuable, because if someone gets lost in the first step and doesn't feel comfortable asking, you know, for clarification, they can just pore over this and in their own time at their own pace. So they explain all these, and, you know, I think maybe, obviously, there's so much we could get into, but the one thing to pivot into the other paper I wanted to talk about was Figure 4 in the Crouch and Mazur article, which is comparing, basically looking at correct versus incorrect, and breaking down how many students, or what percentage of students, went from correct to correct. You know, they stayed, they had the correct answer, they talked to their peer, they maintained the correct answer. But then you also have the more interesting case of incorrect to correct, and the also, of course, important, and hopefully this is not common, which is you go from correct to incorrect. So these are the options, right, that they look at. And so this is Figure 4. And what they find is that many students, when you go through this peer instruction, go from incorrect to correct, even if, and we'll you know, talk about this as we lead into the next article, even if it was a group where both people involved were incorrect. Yeah, it's kind of, that's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Crazy. And think about this. You're basically saying to the instructors, the less you speak and the more the students are doing the speaking.
I know.
The game's afraid of.
Hard, yeah, it's a hard to swallow pill, I think, for a lot of professors.
I mean, it was just crushing, you know? Yeah. I mean, and nowadays we just expect. Now, let's also point out that it's not like students just fell into this and just instantly were speaking to one another. I mean, that was one of the complaints that they had is, you know, the professors were like, look, I'm trying this. And I don't remember if it was this paper or another. They're basically saying the kids won't speak to one another. They sit there. So we really have to walk around and prod them. And, you know, because it was so different. Well, even when I started teaching, students weren't supposed to be speaking. You were judged as a teacher, as an instructor, as how well can you control that class? And if it's silent, you're doing a great job. Now we're saying you want students to talk. What if they start talking about other things than what you wanted them to talk about? I mean, literally, we would have conversations with as instructors and the professors would be like, isn't it just going to snowball? I mean, I remember going and you know, there would be seminars where some of these new ideas were talked about. And there were some that were just furious at this idea. I mean, they were essentially saying, why not just burn down the building now? It's just going to be chaos. And but then when you have, and remember, everyone thinks very highly of physicists at the time. And if you're going to start doing research, you better have all of your numbers exact and this, that, whatever. So they really were striving to impress the physics people. And when they did, I mean, it was just, in some ways, it was a magical time because everyone was starting to think about what are we doing and why are we doing it and what changes should we make? Think about today. I was writing a letter of recommendation for a university. I went to their university physics site just to see what they were all about. One of the very first tabs was, it was, I think, a DEI or something like that. And it just talked about, look, these are all the supports we have in place. If you want extra time for tests, fill out this form. If you would like, if you have anxiety, if you have, I mean, to think of where we started to now, we are welcoming you. Tell us how we can improve for you. I mean, it's just a cosmic jump. It's hard to imagine how things have changed. And so, you know, this type of research that was coming through at this era was, it was tumultuous, but exciting at the same time. So,
absolutely. Yeah, it's, I mean, obviously there's still a long way to go, both on the DEI front and on the education front, but it is pretty remarkable that, you know, we think these things are, like, in hindsight, so obvious to say, but as you point out, there was a lot of resistance, a lot of pushback, and even today, of course, people still, I mean, I had lecturers who I will not name that just basically what they did is they took the textbook in their own time, they wrote down some notes, which were essentially some distilled version of the textbook, and then they copied those notes onto the board, and that was what we did for 3 hours a week. And you know, in grad school, students just stop going. They're just like, if they're going to read from, like, we look at the book and you realize, oh, they're really just going through this and maybe adding a few notes here and there. I'll just read that and save my time. And so the fact that we're now at a point where, you know, so many universities, really, I'd say any university that students want to go to, is going to be a university that focuses on these things. And if you can't find that information on their website and stuff, then that's probably a red flag. But fortunately, a lot of really good universities are coming around to the importance of this. And then also, we're talking so much about the university level, but there's really not that much difference between, you know, high school students, upperclassmen in high school, and first year college students. And so a lot of these techniques are just as valuable at the high school level. And I'm sure there's research into that that you could speak to. And of course, you've implemented maybe not in this exact peer, maybe not exactly peer instruction, but a lot of these other techniques. I know we've been being very positive about everything. And I think I have a tendency to be very excited reading these articles. You see these learning gains. It's so obvious this is the way to do it. But maybe just to be a little pessimistic, We touched on this earlier, but one of the main drawbacks to this is it just takes an enormous amount of time. And that seems like a drawback, obviously, when you're a traditional lecturer and it was the mid-90s, you know, early 2000s, and you were hearing about this, you would say, well, if I do this, I only have 15 minutes to lecture. But of course, what they found is that that's okay, because the lecturing is not actually more lecture does not mean more understanding, right? So they address this. But the fact remains that it does take, if you have a certain amount of content to cover, and at the university level, and of course, we've talked about at the high school level, the standards, of course, the problem with AP exams, so much content in so little time. So it's hard to get teachers to buy into things like this. So with that in mind, can you just comment a little bit, especially at the high school level, one of the main criticisms we've got about the things that we're suggesting, and of course, we aren't the only ones that have suggested this for a really long time. But how do you blend, you know, the constraints that administration and the district puts on teachers with the data that show that if you cover less and if you cover it well and in these ways with active engagement, that students learn more? What would you say to all this before we pivot?
Well, first of all, if the gains are so great and these clickers are so wonderful, why are they not around right now? I mean, some institutions are still using them, but there was a surge where everyone had to use the clickers. Everyone had to use these different techniques, and then they kind of went away. So, you know, there's this balancing act. There's fads that come through. The research is not a fad, but how we react to that knowledge. So a lot of institutions went, everyone has to use a clicker. At some point, you're going to get some backlash too. And the students are like, we don't want to do this every class. We don't want to do this in every discipline. So you have to come to this understanding of, you know, every course is going to be a little bit different about their wants and their needs and what their goals are. So there's not like this one fix all. And while this research is so important, there are other constraints on teachers, on educators, on administrators, on institutions that have to equally be balanced. And so that's why you can't just read one of these research papers and say, I'm fixed. I've got it. I know what to do now. Because the world is complicated. And there is absolutely positively a push to cover less material and do it better. And that's been an absolute positive.
Right.
At the same time, we now have a new technology coming in with all of the computers where students can click through a gazillion problems at a time. And sometimes that's showing increases in scores. And now there's a pressure for that. So now we're almost with new technology saying, okay, yeah, that research was neat and everything, but look what we can do now. We'll look at our scores. So
If you want to do better on, when I was studying for the SAT, Khan Academy, you know, I was able to go on and in my view, my honest view when I was preparing, and I didn't really know what I was doing. It's not like I read a book about, you know, how to study for the SAT. I didn't have a tutor. I was just saying, okay, if there are only, you know, so many types of questions, then I'm just going to do as many questions as I can possibly do. I'm not going to worry about if I have some deep gap in my knowledge. I'm going to do hundreds of questions so that the odds of me getting a question that's similar on the actual SAT, you know, go up. And I have no doubt that that would improve test scores, but I really hope, and we can have several discussions about this down the line, but I really hope to see a shift at the middle school and high school level away from just these tests that do not target understanding, don't target the science standards, but just really cover content. And they equate that with deep understanding, and there's so much more. But we could go on at length, and we shouldn't in this one. What we should do is briefly discuss the other article that we read. And so the lead into that was figure four in the Crouch and Mazur article. And the thing I highlighted was, in addition, the vast majority of students who revise their answers during discussion change from an incorrect answer to a correct answer. So there are some 6% do actually go in, you know, in this in their data, and I would have to read it a little more carefully to see what the sample size and so on and so forth. But there are some students that go from correct to incorrect, a very small fraction. But by and large, if students are revising their answers during peer instruction, they're going from incorrect to correct. So they don't give any explanation of this deeper than just an observation. This is what we found. And that pivots into the article that I was, you know, curious if they actually gave a satisfactory explanation, which is why peer discussion improves student performance. And this is, again, a science article from 2009 from people at Boulder. Carl Wieman, the physics Nobel Prize winner, who pivoted into physics education research, is also on the article, as well as several other researchers. But this was actually in a genetics classroom that they were, the study they were talking about.
Right.
So it's great to see that these active engagement techniques were, you know, adopted well outside. And like you said, they were probably well understood by other fields before. But I just want to get your take on this article. And really, let's just jump into table one. If we can just talk about this first, or figure one, excuse me. And I'll explain it to the listeners. And also, you know, if you're watching this, we'll be putting the actual graphs on the screen. But what they find is basically they ask the question to students. Then they ask them to discuss and then potentially to you know, reassess and answer it again, essentially. And then what they do, and this is the thing that I want to get your input on, is they say, okay, what could be the explanation of, if we see an increase after discussion, couldn't we just be seeing an effect where the more confident students just overpower the less confident students and say, no, you're wrong, here's the right answer, just do this, trust me. You know, you certainly have that dynamic in classrooms. I've seen it. I know you've seen it. But they say, how can we actually test then if there was a change in understanding from peer instruction? And while their answer isn't perfect, what they do is they say, let's give another similar question later.
Yes.
They use the term isomorphic, which is a mathematical term, but really what they mean there is just same form. It's the essentially the story or whatever is surrounding the problem is different, but the actual solution, the concept used and targeted is the same. They use this, and what they find is that there are still increases in that isomorphic or similar clicker question. And so that's pretty much what the first figure is showing, is you see a gain, a significant gain after discussion, and you still see a statistically significant gain on that similar question. And that effect is even more drastic the more difficult the problem is. And so this is the main takeaway of this paper. Very fascinating. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts, and specifically if you think, you know, there are any improvements that could be made, or if you know of any other literature in this direction.
The literature that we're looking for is sociocultural literature in psychology. It turns out that learning is a social process. And as we have even naive, you know, questioners, by asking those questions, it forces even the experts to think more deeply or re-examine. So it makes sense, right? But one of the things that this article did not state that Crouch and Mazur and others have pointed out is that what's really changing here is that we end up getting more females to interact more with the questions. We also get more non-science majors to start interacting with the more hardcore science majors, which means they have questions that they're going to be asking, and now we've got this dialogue that's happening. And what do we see? We see the disparity that we were seeing in gender suddenly kind of disappear. And now being able to ask some of these questions that, you know, one of the things that we notice is students that are more capable or perceived to be more capable are less likely to ask those questions. We now are giving voice to those that are saying, but wait a second, I thought that, and now we get that type of back and forth where I don't need to be as proficient as you to be able to ask you things that can push you forward that you can then explain to me. So you've got this synergistic effect happening. I think that's what we're seeing. We see the results, and we see the disparity between gender go down, and we also see non-science majors that are increasing their game. And remember, the paper that you're talking about right now, they're not doing physics. They're doing other things that are going to end up being biological. They're going to end up using different kinds of inscriptions, diagrams that might not have the mathematical baggage to it. So it's just a fruitful exchange. And you could see how these seminal papers start spreading out in all directions. And then after a very long time, we start to have science people that start to say, what is the education department over there talking about? And once that happens, we're about to see an explosion of real change happen in education. So I think the most important thing of these papers is they were, A, read, and they were taken seriously by the scientists that are often considered the most hardcore, the physics people. And once the physics people start lending their support, I think it just snowballed. And I think we're in a much better situation than we are today, or than we were. We're in a better situation today than we were before. So I don't know if I just answered your question at
all. No, it did. I was mostly just, I always love to hear the context. I mean, you know, this podcast is as much for me, I think, as it is for all the educators out there that are aspiring to do better. I mean, I have so much less experience than you in actually teaching. And so I'm always just eager to hear more and learn myself. And so I always appreciate the context. I thought it was a really fascinating, really, you know, figure one is the sort of money plot. It is, it's just really cool to see that the that there are gains in understanding from before interacting with your peers to after, and that gain is maintained even in a similar question that you answer on your own later. You know, and as they say, this is going from a transmission model to a social constructivist model, where really the learning is not coming from an expert at the front of the board, but is rather coming from the construction, the dialogue of the construction of knowledge through dialogue, even when neither party understood it going in. And that's pretty remarkable. So that's sort of the stuff that I want to talk about. And maybe the sort of summary is that peer instruction, which we will also link a sort of Eric Mazur's sort of step-by-step guide from, I think, 97, peer instruction, a user's manual. Mm-hmm. So we'll link all these for teachers that want to read more about it. How do you actually, you know, they talk about it in the other review article, how do you do lecture pacing? How do you sequence these? You know, how are you actually implementing them? How do you incentivize the students? All these important aspects that we didn't get into will be in these various articles. And there's real value to them, even for time management. And I would say, you know, lecturing at the board when you know it's not effective, it's also, I mean, it can be tiring. These give teachers a chance to sort of take a breath, let the students. So it's a win-win. I mean, it lets the teachers, when I say take a break, obviously you're still walking around and engaging, but that engagement to me always feels much more natural and much less taxing than sitting at the board writing. And so I really think it's a win-win. It obviously, the data show that the learning, that students learn more using this. And so it's really, I think, something that teachers could start experimenting in if they haven't done any sort of thing other than a traditional lecture style. This could be a great gateway, I think, to other, you know, pedagogies. So if you have any closing thoughts, I'd love to hear them. But otherwise, I think that's roughly what I wanted to discuss in regards to peer instruction.
The way this ties in with what we are talking about is wherever you are, jump in. And if you don't have time to read all of these, read the abstract, read the first page, at least listen to what we're saying if you have no other time. But every piece that you gain is just another tool in your totally. Tool bag that allows you to improve your art of teaching. And so you get the art, you get the science behind it, and it's a wonderful thing. And as we'll do in coming discussions, we'll talk about, well, have we gone too far, and do we need to start swinging back? Because at some point, you still need that expert to help guide you along. What is the new place of the teacher right. in the classroom, and how do we most effectively leverage that? So it's been a nice series of papers here. Enjoyed the talk, and always nice talking with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I look forward to future discussions. There's so many dynamics that we can't cover, and I think that's a great topic for future discussion. How do you fit in as the expert in the classroom to best help students, even when you're using these modern pedagogical methods? So, as always, I learn a lot from talking with you, so thank you so much. And I hope that the listeners at least take away that peer instruction is an easy to implement and valuable tool that they could add to their repertoire. So, as always, thanks, Wargo, and I'll see you in the next one.